Hey folks, this is Callum from Bite Marks, just with a quick disclaimer before you start here. We're doing an analysis today on Eastward, which is a story-heavy game, and this video unfortunately contains quite a lot of spoilers, because you can't really do a video on a story-heavy game without there being spoilers. I'm rambling. Anyway, if you haven't played Eastward, I suggest you go and play it. It's a game that I would recommend to basically anyone. It's great. If you don't really care, then feel free to keep watching. But just keep in mind, there's lots of spoilers in here. And thank you so much for checking it out. Have a good day and enjoy watching the video. Oh my god, get me out of this hell. Bye! Hi everyone, and welcome to Bite Marks, a podcast by gamers for gamers about politics, and about specifically my favorite game of the year so far. My name's Callum, and I'm joined by my co-host Amelia.
Hi everybody, I don't usually sit silently while the... I usually do the intro,
weird, right?
So this is a new experience for me. Yeah,
it's very weird to wait for someone to stop talking. So that you can say your name. It's an experience that is only ever done in shows and school.
Yeah, that's true. Callum is going to be doing... Well, this is a Callum episode. and we're going to be talking about a game which will probably be his best game of the year. So, spoilers for that video that we're going to do at the end of the year.
I mean, the year is still happening. It's like May. Whatever.
Yeah. My two best games so far of the year. I both played them in January.
I don't know. It also depends what theme we're going for this year. We've really written ourselves
that'll sort
into
itself
a
out.
Corner with that idea.
Oof, yeah. Foresight, you know.
Anyway.
2020.
Emilio, what's your favorite direction? Cardinal direction?
It's gotta be north, my man.
Gross.
Because I love following trade
Gross.
Winds.
What? Gross.
Because I'm a bird. Cough.
Why would you say that? That's the antithesis of this channel. Well, I personally like East. I love tea.
Weeb.
I love tea. What can I say? I love drinking tea. It's beautiful out there, and there's something about traveling eastward. Which is what we're doing today. A video on Eastward, a game I reviewed recently that I loved. It's like gotten the best score I've ever given a game in my life. And I've been...
That actually
Yeah, I've been
quite
doing
lot,
this job for like 11 years now.
You are a seasoned video game
Yeah,
reviewer.
that season is that salt.
Yeah, you gave it a 9.5, Ooh. Right? You're only
out
9.5.
No, out of 10.
Out of a billion.
It's here's the thing. I think we should start off with this point because it's, you know, it just feels natural, but I want to talk quickly about, like, reviewing and what goes into that and why it's kind of weird. Because I've worried a lot about the score I gave this game, you know? It's a really high score. I've always held true that, like, a game is never going to get a 10 from me because I don't think there's ever going to be a perfect game.
You've got your journalistic integrity.
I mean, yeah, you can buy that. It's just no one has tried yet.
Hear that, EA? Callum is for sale.
Buy me a house and I'll give you whatever numbers you want, my dude. but yeah, it's just... So, there's this idea that you have to be incredibly objective with reviews. And I've always hated that idea.
I also kind of hate that idea as well. You go to a reviewer to get their opinion. You're not going to, like, a random, like, you know, robot that's just going to spit out a number at you. You're going to get a human being's opinion, and that human being is going to have biases and
I mean,
stuff
it's just
like that.
Influences. I remember there was I don't remember where I heard it, but I heard there was a, like, a psychological experiment that was done where they measured the brain activity in people when they were trying to think of new ideas, and they found out that the part of the brain that lights up when you're trying to think of something new is the same part of the brain where we think memories might be stored. So it Whoa. Literally, you never have a new idea. You just approach an idea that you've had before at a new angle.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. you kind of can't really trust. I certainly wouldn't trust the opinion of a reviewer who had not played video games before, right?
I mean, it would offer a very fresh layman's take, but they wouldn't know. They would be blown away because it would be like experiencing movies for the first time or walking out of a cave that you've lived in for 30 years and seeing a train.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, hypothetically, the most objective reviewer that could exist is a person that just hasn't played any other video games, so their experience is fresh. But I don't trust that person. And also, I think they would give a strange opinion, you know? So, what is your feeling about reviewing? Is it the fact that you gave this game a very high score and you're worried about that?
I'm worried that it doesn't feel like I'm trying hard enough to look for the faults in it. Because a lot of the three things I hate about reviews, or how people see reviews. One, I hate that people think it needs to be objective. It isn't. It's basically an opinion article just about a specific game in general, rather than any specific part of a game. Two, I hate that you have to use numbers as a score. I don't think you can really boil down an opinion into a number. I hate that I have to do it. It's the worst. And three, I hate that people think that reviewing means you just have to say, like, what's wrong with something, because that's not the case. A review should highlight what's the flaws in a creation, obviously, but also the positives, because if you just say what's wrong, the creator is going to think nothing worked, and they're going to throw out all their ideas and try again with something completely new, and that's not how you grow. If you just say what's right, they're going to think that nothing went wrong, and they're going to keep all of their mistakes, and after a while, if you keep a mistake going for long enough, it stops being a mistake and starts being a habit. Look at Ubisoft, and fucking towers, and icons on maps, and shit. We needed to have said something earlier. But you have to say both, and it often felt with, like, Eastwood, I wasn't talking enough about the bad stuff because I was just so excited to have played a game that made me excited. I mean, you and I talked while I was playing this game. You said you had never seen me so excited about something.
Yeah, viewers at home, Callum, I've literally never seen him this excited about a video game. And that's saying something, because Callum, his life is, you know, our lives are pretty much video games.
That's the saddest at least anyone has ever said to me. That
hey, I also have war games and, like, swords and some
like
other
3 years ago or something. I was at a bar and a girl said to me, "You look like you play video games," and I almost cried. It's the saddest thing.
But Callum, would a guy who plays video games go to a bar
all the time?
I suppose.
It was really exciting to play a game that, like, I loved, because I've don't know if I've spoken to you about it before, but I've certainly said it in enough of my articles. I think a lot of games miss charm. Like, they don't have enough charm in them. One of the biggest problems I have with games like Dark Souls and The Witcher and whatever is that they're great games, they're beautifully told stories, they're really wonderful aesthetics. It's just, it doesn't feel like saving the world is gonna help.
Yeah, that's kind of not really the point, you know. Those games are sort of deeply cynical about the idea of even saving the world.
And maybe Dark Souls Dark Souls is a bad example of that, because that's literally as far from the point as you can get. But take Skyrim, you know.
Are you Todd Howard up here? Says he reaches through the screen and just gives you a copy of Skyrim.
Okay, in Skyrim, you're literally destined to save the world, and everyone, like, is expecting you to. You can kill a dragon in front of someone. The harbingers of doom in this frozen wasteland, torn apart by war, no one even bats an eyelid. No one seems to care as long as you get out of their cabbage patch by tomorrow. And maybe that's, like, a realistic version of the game. Like, maybe everyone would just be a disassociated and completely numb to it by now, because it's just been happening for so long. But, I mean, I need a reason to save the world.
Yeah. Yeah, you need a reason to care. I think one of the problems with, quote-unquote, grounded/gritty/realistic narrative design is that you often lose the ability to really highlight some of the strengths of video games specifically as a medium. Because you can make a person feel something by doing a thing in a video game. You can't do that in other types of media. You can't make someone feel an emotion by just, you know, with a book, they have to read the thing, but they're not doing
the thing.
There's
always a degree of separation.
Exactly, yeah. And, like, you hear it when you read about, like, interviews about the original, like, Legend of Zelda design process, right? The point of that game is to capture a feeling of being a kid, or at least a young person, exploring. And sure, the graphics are kind of terrible, and yeah, the game is actually kind of difficult. I've actually played it, and I can tell you it's not necessarily very fun. But if you had never played a video game like Zelda before, the first one, and you played that game, I genuinely believe it would emote in you, or evoke in you, a feeling of exploration and discovery and the childlike joy of discovery.
Of what Miyamoto must have felt when he was literally exploring caves near his home when he was a kid. That's what they based the game on, and that's what it evokes. It's great.
Yeah, you don't get that sense with a game like Skyrim.
But you know what? I'm glad you brought up Zelda. Because I feel that we may have gotten onto a tangent a bit early. Let me cycle back the tape here a little. Eastwood is an action-adventure RPG. It's kind of Zelda-esque, set in the world of Eastwood. It's about a man named John, who is the top digger in an underground city of the Potrock Isle.
Oh, okay. So, like, is this a fantasy
setting?
It's
kind of Ghibli-esque. Sort of like ancient technology fantasy. Actually, to the point that they put Hayao Miyazaki in the game. He sells fish and smokes. No, he sells milk and smokes.
You know, you told me about this. You know, you. I remember you telling me this, and even perhaps showing me, but somehow it's still... That's still hilarious to me, the fact that they would make a Ghibli-looking video game, and then they'd put Miyazaki in it, and he sells cigarettes and milk.
I mean, he doesn't sell cigarettes, he just smokes them. But, I literally... The game has the... obviously, it's like 16-bit pixel graphics, but it has an intro cinematic that you can watch and skip before the start screen. I watched the intro cinematic, and my first thought was, this looks like a Ghibli movie.
I've had that experience as well. This game is published by Chucklefish. And viewers, if you don't know Chucklefish, they're like... Okay, so all video game publishers are basically evil, but they're a big...
We had this conversation before we started.
Yeah, I was like, oh yeah, they're like the EA of indie games, but they're good, but...
That doesn't work, no, because good video game publisher, the antithesis of what EA is.
But they make a lot of... They publish a lot of games. One of the games that they published is one of my favorite games, Wargroove. And Wargroove starts with this anime, like, really... Like, almost like Avatar level of animation, in my opinion. Of, like, these guys doing... martial arts and sword fights, and it's so crisp and just like earnest. You know, I get the feeling, yes, I want to play this game because the the animation is actually, I've played a couple of games where they have like an intro cinematic that is like strangely well animated.
Yeah, the intro cinematic from Dragon Ball Z Budokai 3 is burnt into my lobes.
What?
It burns into my lobes forever. Not the other one. I didn't say the other one. Anyway, Eastwood is it's great. You're John. You basically are a mine worker in this underground city until you find a young girl in a tub, in like a not tub is the wrong word in like a pod filled with liquid. It's like a Saiyan pod. Healing pod.
Oh, so she's like an artificial human. Oh, by the way, we forgot to mention this. This will definitely be a spoiler.
Oh, no, it's in the disclaimer. I put the disclaimer before the video, don't worry.
Okay, great.
But so, yeah, just yeah, in so case.
She's like an artificial
just
human.
Just in case you didn't hear the disclaimer, this is spoiler heavy. But yeah, she's an artificial human, basically.
Okay. I'm on board so far.
Essentially, okay, so essentially, there was this city called Esther City, where... The characters from Final Fantasy 1 basically saved two little girls who were magic from a demon king.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they brought her back to Esther City. And then a scientist named Solomon created an artificial human from them that's like the highest point of human evolution because of fucking course it is. It's okay. Anime.
Like a neo-human.
A neo-human, a mega-human.
A Mew-man. that was my one Pokemon joke that I'm allowed to make.
A
Mew-tuman. Goddammit, you beat me to the punch.
Anyway, so yeah, they make this like ultimate human called Mother. Basically, the little girls had...
Symbolism.
Yeah, it's symbolism. She's the mother of the new human race. Do you want them to spell it out for you more? These little girls, the one had the ability to create. That's the main character, Sam. Well, the secondary main character, Sam. And the other one, who doesn't really get a name, she has the power to destroy.
Okay, classic yin-yang.
Yeah, they get...
I'm with you so far.
It's kind of weird. It's hard to tell if like the whole Demon King stuff actually happened or if that was just like... a metaphor or something, but I think it actually happened. They made it seem like it, but those little two girls were like essentially fused together to make a perfect being.
this world is giving me kind of like, I'm gonna say this and it's probably not gonna seem related, but like Hyper Light Drifter vibes, where you have a world that almost looks magical, but like if you think about it, it could all just be like technology, you know?
Yeah,
like
I guess so. I haven't played Hyper Light Drifter.
Like you could make a mythological interpretation that these two little girls were like the spiritual embodiment of like creation and destruction, or maybe they were just like super soldier human beings that were engineered to, you know, do like that's kind of the vibe.
Yeah,
that
because
I'm getting, where it could be fantasy, but it could also just be. The technology is so advanced that it might as well be.
Yeah, right. I mean, Sam has magic, but very few people actually describe it as magic. Only like the people who have never really seen like intense technology before describe it as magic. The one inventor character literally says, "How do you produce energy like that?"
Ah, see, I love that. I love that like implication of like, oh yeah, it's just. Maybe it is magic, but maybe it's just super advanced technology, and it only appears like magic because we're back in the Stone Ages, you know, in terms of technology.
Okay, so, that's essentially, super cool. Well, what happened is that they kept this... It's also kind of hard to tell what it is exactly, but Charon is like the organization, being, collective, whatever, that wants to create the perfect version of humanity... keeps unleashing this thing called the miasma, which essentially is this like black goop that eats the world. It almost deletes everything.
Okay. Ooh, okay. So it could be actual black goop, or it could be like nanomachines.
Yeah,
yes. You know, or something.
but yeah, basically they've done that quite a few times now, so the world is very post-apocalyptic.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it's that cool kind of post-apocalyptic where it's like the world has been overgrown with plants.
Yeah, yeah. Civilization collapsed. There's a skyscraper, but also it's like full of plants. So
it's pretty post-apocalyptic. That like that Ghibli thing of like Nausicaa and the Valley of the Waves, Valley of the Wind.
Yeah, yeah.
so yeah, basically. John finds Sam. She is the good half of this pairing. She's completely lost her memories and her powers, and they sort of live together as surrogate father and daughter.
So, Last of Us situation. We got a Last of
Keep
Us situation.
That in mind, because we're going to be talking about that trope in a bit. so, they're living in, like, adopted suburban bliss or whatever, and eventually, Sam wants to go to school. She does, and... she kind of awakens Not right. Not quite. Sorry. She goes to school. She gets a lucky coin from a small boy. You have to help her out with a bunch of things. That's the thing, is it's so hard to remember specific moments in this game because it takes its time. You know, it takes time to establish all of the characters and their personalities. And that's probably why it sat so well with me, because I was pretty clear on everyone. Everyone felt very distinct, like different people, but they were all fairly well established as who they were. And it introduces you to the world slowly, and I like that. It never felt rushed, and it never felt too slow. It can, at certain points, in like Chapter 7, don't get me wrong, or Chapter 6 or whatever, but for the most part, it's pretty well-paced.
What's, while we're on this tangent, what is the gameplay like?
It's like Zelda, kind of.
So it's very much like you wander around, you have like limited abilities, maybe light RPG elements, something like that.
Okay. So you play as John for most of the combat. He has a frying pan, which he uses to cook food that gives you health and benefits. He smacks things with the frying pan. Think of that as like a sword. It has an arc and whatever.
Okay.
You basically have to get to the end of like a dungeon and maybe defeat a boss. Some dungeons are more puzzle heavy, some dungeons are just sort of combat heavy, and once you defeat the boss, you'll generally get an extra heart. You start at like 3, and then you get to 4, you can find like...
Oh, so it really is Zelda.
Yeah, very much so. You get bombs really early on that you use.
Of course.
but what's cool about it is how it kind of evolves. Every single tool is multi-purpose. Even John's clever frying pan, because it gets broken in the first dungeon, and you get it repaired, and then you get a charge ability, and they show you in game like, why don't you hit that fruit with the charge ability, and you see it move, and then later on I was in a dungeon and I was like, I have to blow something up, but it's across this chasm, and my brain started working for the first time in 3 years, and I was like, wait, I can put down a bomb and hit it with the charge attack. And that becomes a huge mechanic for solving puzzles throughout the whole game.
That sounds like really good game design,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, I'm struggling to find a point of bad game design, to be honest. I mean, there's some things, but it's mostly because of the Switch. I played this on Switch, by the way. The Switch isn't super great at aiming, so... yeah. Hmm.
Do you think this would be better on a PC or, like, another console?
I don't know. I think PC
like maybe
would...
maybe PlayStation, Xbox?
No, I think PC would probably be the best, because there is a fair amount of precision you have to do.
Okay.
When an enemy's jumping around and you're trying to use the gun, it's kind of short range, but it also kind of needs you to be on target when you shoot.
Oh, there's a gun.
There's...
that would never be in a Zelda game.
Yeah. There's a frying pan, a gun, a gun that shoots saw blades...
I love that.
And a plant, like, pesticide sprayer that gets modified into a flamethrower.
Okay.
Yeah, because you needed to burn, like, brambles to unlock certain parts of the map.
Okay, so, yeah, a weapon, but also a mobility tool. Yeah, I like that. I like that sort of dual-purpose design. Oftentimes, I think one of the issues that I have with a lot of action games is that you get a thing and you kind of only use it once. The ways that you use it feel very contrived. If we ever do a review or a discussion about like Darksiders Genesis, which is a game that I really actually very much liked, it has that problem a lot.
I'd be keen to do
that. For its puzzle mechanics. It also has a co-op mode. I wonder if we could play it. But anyway, you were saying.
But let's hop back. Yeah, basically the only weapon that doesn't do an extra thing is the gun. But here's the thing. Okay, let's slip into the next topic I want to bring up, and it's gameplay as a vehicle for story. Now, the whole premise of the story from the beginning onwards is that Sam keeps having dreams about traveling east, about going to the surface, and eventually you come back and you get banished for it, because it's forbidden to go to the surface in the Podrock Isles. So then you start your adventure.
Fallout 1 logic.
Yeah, basically, Fallout logic. Then you start your adventure, you start traveling and stuff, and eventually Sam awakens her magic. Sam's magic is capable of stunning creatures. So it's basically like an orb of energy she shoots out. It's mostly used for problem solving, like destroying certain plants that only mm-hmm. react to it, activating the ancient technology that's obviously from the point where she was made, which makes sense why she can activate it.
Okay.
But it's also for stunning enemies, which gives John free hits on them. Because all the enemies do...
So there's a synergy here.
Yeah, all the enemies do point of contact damage. So you can basically get free hits without taking damage.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
Here's the thing. Sorry, you were going to say something?
No, go ahead.
Here's the thing that I think solidifies why Eastwood needed to be a game instead of like an anime movie or a manga or whatever. Eastwood uses these elements of its gameplay to tell you more about its characters. John is kind of like the strong silent type in general. He's sort of a blunt instrument, but he's very adaptable to situations. Hence why most of his mm-hmm. weapons are multi-purpose. And his literal signature weapon is a blunt instrument.
Yeah, I guess John must also be a very honest man.
Yeah.
Is that what you're trying to build up to? Yeah, okay, that's... Okay.
Sam, on the other hand, is limited because she is a child and also she doesn't have her memories and everything. So her powers can only stun. However, she is also naturally very helpful. Hence why her powers are mainly used for activating puzzles or stunning enemies or putting up shields or healing.
Support. Yeah, she has a very support-oriented skill set.
Yeah. And it's like, I only noticed that stuff when I was done playing. And...
Yeah, because it feels very natural while they just fall into these paradigms and you just pick up and then you go.
Yeah. I think it's a very rare feeling to find a game where you kind of have to talk to everyone to get, like, the really... Not the whole story, but, like, a deeper view of the world. But you want to mm-hmm. talk to everyone.
Mm.
Like, the game just makes it so easy to want to talk to everyone. And that's why it needs to be a game. Because you literally get to decide your level of immersion. You can...
Yeah, do you blitz through or do you actually talk to everyone?
Yeah.
Are there hub towns?
It's more like levels, really. It's more like different worlds. Because the game is split into chapters, about 8 or 9.
So it's very linear, not open world.
No, not really. You can kind of go around the overworld and where the monsters are and stuff, but it's quite linear.
That's you know, some people might call that a criticism. Actually, I actually really prefer linear games.
Yeah, I'm so tired of open world games.
Yeah, maybe it's because I'm an adult and I've got responsibilities now, but like, just give me the game. I don't want to have to, you know, faff about looking for endless things. I just want to play the experience and then go, you know?
I mean, that's not to say there isn't exploring and stuff. Man, I'm having so much trouble talking about this now.
I think it's probably a mark of, like, have you ever had a really, really good cheeseburger?
Yes. Well,
yeah.
Sort of.
So, well, when I used to eat meat, because I'm a vegetarian now, you know, I remember thinking I had one burger one time at this one place, and if you asked me to describe it to you, I would struggle, right? I would have to start busting out like food review terms, you know, to talk about the texture and stuff like that. But really, the vibe of that burger, the feeling of eating it, was just good, right?
It's
and when something
it's also like that thing of like every thought you have on this is trying to get out of your mouth.
Yeah. It's easier to talk about something when it's bad, you know, than when it's good, because especially with video games, because when a game is good, it's fun to play and you get lost playing it. That's not quite when it's bad. That's when the immersion is it's breaking down, where the gameplay mechanics are frustrating. That's really why you feel so strongly about bad video games, is because it viscerally reminds you that this is not working. But when a game is good, you lose yourself. your brain just naturally works and picks up everything the game is putting down, and you kind of struggle. You actually, it's a bit of an effort, really, to actively pay attention and still to be critical while you're playing a game that you very much enjoy.
I rarely screwed up my sleep schedule because of Eastwood.
That's high praise indeed.
I would like start the game at 10 at night, and I think to myself, man, oh man, I'm gonna play this for like, I don't know, 3 hours maybe, and then I'll go to sleep. And I would look at my phone and be like 1 in the morning, and I'd be like, okay, well, I can just like play a little bit longer. I mean, it's fine. And then I'd look at my phone and it'd be 6 in the morning.
Oh no.
And I'd be like, oh, okay. I just want to gush about it for a bit. Like, it's so cool. Every character is interesting, and, well, not even interesting, really. Not every character is interesting, I shouldn't
lie. What was your,
Yeah?
What was your favorite moment that comes to mind? Like, if I say, hey, Kellum, what's your favorite moment?
I don't know. The whole thing? No, actually, there's this great moment where, you go on a date with... Well, no, you get asked on a date by a townsperson in the first town you get to after leaving the Potrock Isle in, like, chapter 2 or something. And it's very sweet. The whole town pitches in to try and make this date work because they love the lady who's, like, trying to date you. And she, like, is so into you, and it's so cute, and she loves Sam, and, like, Sam loves it there. It's a really cute town. They all live in, like, old-style steamboats, but on a grassy field.
Ah, that's awesome. That's so cool.
And then that town gets fucking murked.
That's a Ghibli thing. Ooh!
Yeah, at the end of chapter 2, it gets deleted by the miasma, just so that you can feel the pain of what's happening to the world. It took...
Yeah.
That whole section literally took, like... maybe 3 to 4 hours to play and like experience everything and stuff. Maybe I might be over exaggerating, but it took that long, and then they just wiped it out, and I was like, excuse me? That's when I knew this was a good game, because I was like, you just made me feel things. Stop.
Yeah, you know, you have to get the player invested in the people that you're invariably going to murder to make them feel bad.
There was a... I was on Twitter the other day where I saw Joe Cat, who is also a YouTuber. He's really popular. If you listen to our videos, you're probably going to like his. Go and look him up. He did the crap guide to, like, D&D and Monster Hunter and stuff.
Yes. Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about.
Well, he started this thread on Twitter about, like, how games don't need to be fun. There's no...
Ooh, that's a spicy
meatball. Yeah, there's no one... as he says, there's no one thing a game needs to be, because games are art. Mm. And there's no one thing art needs to be, except... unless you can, like, think of something. And I answered back... I don't know if he ever saw it, because I think people were being really weirdly toxic on that thread, so he probably deleted it. But, I answered back that the only thing that art needs to be is engaging. Because I don't like horror, but I can still consider a horror movie or game good if it engages you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's that old question about if a tree falls in the forest but no one is around to see it, you know, did it actually fall? Well, is art really art if it doesn't do something to you, you know? Like, there's a reason why people have such a strong hatred of, like, those corporate... Like, you know, the internet was like a buzz about this like several months, if possibly a year ago. Time is weird, right? You know, with that Grubhub stuff, with Grubhub were making those ads, and everyone was just, you know, collectively shitting on them because it was very obviously corporate produced, very obviously like uninteresting as art, right? It was just there to sell a product. And I think people have that response to those types of things. You can have art that's bad, right? You can have video games that are bad or games that are provocative, but the game needs to do something. A game that is completely, almost in a way, a game that is completely inoffensive or it fails to elicit any emotion, really, is almost worse than a game that is terrible.
Like, I mean, right? If a game makes you angry, at least you're feeling something from it. I've played games that made me feel nothing. I just sat there and like I played it and then I left and it went out of my mind completely. And that's worse. Mm-hmm, yeah. That's the worst thing a game or a book or a movie can do. I mean...
Yeah, and I think you're right, though. Art has to be engaging. And this game sounds like it's it very engaging.
It engaged me from like start to finish. Like, I couldn't put it down.
Mm.
And it's weird. It's like... You get to these moments where occasionally you'll find something, like a movie or a show or a book or a game, that feels like it was made specifically for you. This feels like it was made specifically for me.
Oh.
It has Zelda mechanics that are very smooth, very polished. I love Zelda games. I've always loved Zelda games. I love puzzles in action RPGs. It just works for me.
Mm-hmm.
It looks great. I was amazed how emotive 16-bit characters were. But I could actually see the emotion on their faces.
I always like 16-bit games, man. I'm not... You know, art direction is forever. Graphics are temporary. I really do think that... maybe it's my nostalgia speaking, but the 16-bit era graphics, they just bring out something in me.
Man,
you know?
And any art style can look good in a game, you know? Like,
yeah.
There were plenty of games that did cel shading that looked terrible, and then Breath of the Wild came along and looked fucking awesome.
Yeah, Nintendo don't... I struggle to think of any games that are made by Nintendo that are not visually gorgeous, you know? At least for their time. Or visually interesting, maybe, is the better word to describe it, because, like...
A video for another time, because I'm going to start trying to think of one. The next thing, I love the soundtrack. It just sounded good. Mm-hmm, there are children
good.
Next door that are screaming. In that, like, in that way that they're not being murdered, but apparently they really want to be. I'm losing my track of thought. Damn you, children!
Yeah, so the sound design is great, right? You feel like here's a thing that I often, you know, I think is overlooked, but like, what is the feedback when you do like an action? Does it feel like yes? I did a thing, the game is rewarding me with a stimulus.
Here's the thing.
You know, because there's a... Let me give you an example. So there's a game called Kingdom, mm-hmm. right? And one of the biggest, like, neuron-activated moments in that game is when you get money. Because when you get money, it doesn't just, like, increase a counter at the top of your screen. They take the money and it physically falls into a bag of coins. And they make, like, a jittery sound.
I hate money, but I love that noise.
Right? So that's a great example of, like, good, rewarding stimulus, right? That's like a neuron active. So does this game have that?
I'm struggling to remember, but I feel like it does. It feels like the sound effects were very appropriate for the theming. Because I remember thinking, like, this isn't the kind of game that needs a visceral noise when you hit something with the pan, because that would ruin the tone.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, it felt very, like... comic book sound.
Kapow,
thing. Yeah,
kind
pow,
of thing.
Zwack, whatever. it felt like that and felt appropriate.
Yeah, you know, when it, like, the adage with all of this is that when you don't notice it, then you know it's doing its job. It's when you notice it, that's when, you know, there's an issue.
Yeah. Or it's doing really, really well. And the story was good. I loved the writing in it. Certainly, there are some really weak parts. The Monkey Hollywood part felt kind of weak.
The monkey? That's a sentence.
Yeah, there's a whole section. Because one of the breeding robots, like, tried to evolve monkeys. And then it gained sentience.
Mm-hmm.
And they created Hollywood. I think it was a monkeys and typewriters pun.
That feels... Callum, I'm going to be honest with you. That feels like a joke from Monkey Island.
Yeah. It was, I don't know, it was weird. Like, it wasn't the best section in the game. In fact, I think it was the weakest. Also, it has a forced stealth section, which is always the worst.
Yeah. Forcing the player to do anything, especially when, you know, they're not used to it, that can be a bad thing. See the upcoming video essay about something that's... You know,
man, we really do laugh like nerds. We just go like, anyway, the I too much. The other thing.
We laugh like Dark Souls characters. I will say that. I think we laugh like Dark Souls, like Patches. I think that's who we laugh like. It's true. It's true. We don't do tarnished. A big hearty ho, 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 ho,
I see you like, own fingers tarnished. Do you want some weird things tarnished?
Anyway, no, stop distracting me. I want to talk about references. This game does references that are only applicable to me. Because for some reason, they reference anime, South African colonial history.
That was unexpected.
Classic movies, and the band Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Was this game made by, like, some guys
from Korea? I don't know, it was made by people who have, like, deep, intimate knowledge of my mindscape. It's made by a small company in Shanghai.
Well, you know, that's pretty great.
I might be reading into it too much, but when you have someone named Dagama who's selling spices and wearing an explorer kit, like, it feels very much like they're trying to be like, oh, that's Vasco Dagama.
Well, you know, Shanghai does have, like, a history of colonialism, so maybe it's like, who hasn't the British Empire victimized, you know?
Yeah, but it's weird that it's specifically Vasco da Gama, right? Like, I know he was famous, but he's so relevant to this country.
I'm pretty sure he was relevant
to China. Yeah, but he's, like, also relevant. How many things are relevant to South Africa that are also relevant to China?
That's true. That's
besides, like, BRICS. Or I suppose BIX now. I don't think Russia is allowed to be a part of that anymore. Which, I feel like that should have been the thing from the beginning, because now we can get sponsored by pens and lighters.
Yes. The big pen.
But yeah,
you know,
so Dagama, there's Hayao Miyazaki, there's a monkey version of Sylvester Stallone, there's...
So just regular
Sylvester. Just Sylvester, there's... Fuck, what's the other one? There's Earth, Wind, and Fire, who are a circus troupe.
Aren't they also a band?
They're part of a circus troupe. They're not a band in the game. But they do literally pose and say Earth, Wind, and Fire at one point.
Is that also not an Avatar reference?
No, how would that be an Avatar reference?
The elements, but they're posing... Right.
It's Earth, Wind, Fire, and BDSM, I guess. It's very self-explanatory in the game. It would take too long.
That makes sense. How does the game end exactly? Do you like the ending?
I enjoyed it, but I feel it was a bit esoteric, and it can be difficult to parse exactly what happened. I mean, like, you kind of get it if you've been paying attention, but when you really think about it, you're like, does that make sense? I don't know. Basically, Sam and the Dark Sam fight at Esther City, in the ruins of Esther City. They combine into one being when Solomon tries to kill you, and, like, your friend and his robot son jump in the way, and the robot son dies. Then they go as it happens. They go to the, like, genetic engineering plant. You meet the character Isabel, who I want to talk about later in the trope section, who you fight in one of the coolest fights in the game. Because it's a timing-based fight. You have to swing your pan at the same time she swings her sword to block it. And then it, like, ends in, like, a button-mashing thing. And the timing gets crazy. She eventually starts jumping behind you, so you have to turn around and then get the timing right. And that gets incorporated into the final boss fight. It's great.
Okay. Now that makes
then
sense.
The game ends with you killing a dragon, who was maybe a train at one point, I think. And then Dark Sam turns into, like, a god, and then she has, like, a hole in the middle of her, and then Good Sam turns into an orb of energy and flies into that hole, and they become complete, and then they disappear from existence while John's crying. And then John is at a train station dressed like a hobo,
presumably a few years later, and there's a young girl that looks a lot like Sam and has the name Sam, so it's heavily implied that she reincarnated, and she, like, waits for the train with John. And it's very sweet.
And... okay. That's... You were complaining about an esoteric ending of a video game, but that doesn't sound... It sounds like the kind of thing that you could build up to in a story over a while and then feel satisfied by it,
I think I can talk about it now. I reviewed it. The other game, Raven's Hike, that I played directly after this one. Poor game. It never stood a chance. Mm-hmm. It also had an esoteric ending. But the problem is, it never set it up. It never set up an esoteric ending. But Eastward does. Everything is, like, kind of vaguely mysterious. There's this...
yeah, even from the beginning, it sounds like a strange premise for a game.
Yeah, they never explain, for instance, why there are essentially sentient robots. That's just something that you have to take as accepted, that you're not going to know everything mm-hmm. about this world. And that feels like a through line for the entire story, so I just didn't really mind the esotericness of it. And in fact, in the moment, it made perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the one problem I did have with the game is that I think it falls into too many tropes.
Ah, and that brings us to one of the reasons why we wanted to do this episode, talking about tropes.
Yeah, let's get to the big one last. Let's start off with a smaller one, which is the bearded dad game trope.
Right, the dad of war.
Eastward is a dad of war for sure, because you're essentially a kid's surrogate father in the apocalypse. But it never mm-hmm. feels like that. Because in a lot of Dad of War games, you know, it often feels like they don't really connect to their kid. Like, they're just protecting them, but there's no actual emotional connection there. In Eastward, Sam likes John. She freaking loves the guy. He cooks her meals, he's really nice to her, he takes her to school and stuff. He clearly cares about her, too. And he's just, like, quiet. Mm. He never comes off as, like, angry or surly or sour or whatever. He's just kind of like a quiet dude. So I don't know if it falls into that trope. What do you think?
Well, from what you've described and some of the reading that I've done, it sounds like... So the one of the problems, I think, with the dad of war type trope is that the kid in that relationship is very rarely a character. Mm. They're more often than not a foil for the father to learn lessons.
Yeah.
Like, Atreus in God of War is not his own character per se. He's there to make his father, Kratos, sigh deeply whenever he does something.
Oh, hang on. I think I just saw sounds, Emilio. What? How did you pronounce Kratos' name?
Kratos?
What? They say it in game, and it's Kratos, my dude. I will fight you on this, and you can watch that fight on Patreon, probably. Anyway, you were saying?
I could've... Okay, Kratos. I swear that it sounds like it would... Viewers who are Greek...
No, don't start, like... trying to pronunciation shame me. They made the choice to make his name Kratos, and people in the game that they made from the official source pronounce it Kratos.
I thought it would have been pronounced Kratos. Anyway, the issue is that Kratos is meant to develop off the issues that Atreus brings up. So it sounds like this is not necessarily that trope, because Sam is her own character.
You do play as her.
Yeah, riddle me this, right? Like, could you imagine a game, the same version of the game, but you only play as Sam, and maybe they tweak some other things, but, like, narratively, you only play as Sam, and maybe you have John as your companion, but you don't get to play as him.
Yeah, I can imagine that. It wouldn't be nearly as good, because the tandem gameplay really works in this game's favor, and it does display their relationship and the growing trust between them.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the point that I was going to get to. It's like, yeah, you don't necessarily need one to have the other, and therefore they're both their own characters, but their combination together is much better than both of them alone. And so that's not necessarily it, because the issue with the Dad of War type trope is that The kid doesn't really do much.
He's like a he didn't do much he's developing. A plot device more than a character. He's like the White Walkers in Game of Thrones before season 8.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the plot device. Sam doesn't sound too much like... I mean, she is kind of a plot device from what you've
only
described.
Only in like the very later part of the game. But it really does show you like how much you miss her when you don't have her on your team in that like final mission.
Yeah, both, I imagine, sort of narratively, but also mechanically, because she has lots of useful
abilities. There's specifically, like, enemies that you kind of need to stun to kill, and you don't have Sam in that section, and, like, it's a very tough fight. A fight that should be trivial becomes so much harder, and then she kind of appears later on for the final boss fight and level and stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that totally makes sense. So, yeah, that's the one trope. What's the other one?
Well, togetherness. It's no secret that, like, LGBTQI characters get kind of mistreated in media. Any minority,
racial minorities.
Any minority kind of gets mistreated. If you're not straight, white, and cis, you kind of get mistreated in media. There is a specific trope called bury your gaze. And another trope that I think might fit the game a little bit better, but I'm like, it's one of the bigger worries I also had when I was giving it such a high score, is I don't know if I should be scoring something that well if it has this trope that specifically kind of, you know, denigrates against the community I'm a part of. But yes. It's weird, because bury your gaze, just for everyone who doesn't know, bury your gaze is a trope where two characters will reveal that they're gay and get into a relationship, and then either one of them or both of them will die tragically, because essentially they're almost done in like a token way to display like, hey, look, we're cool with gay people, we don't actually want them affecting the story, so we're gonna kill them.
Yeah, the other argument that maybe you could make about that is that they're killed off in a moralistic sense, where it's like, oh, you find out that they're gay and then they die, as if, you know, to imply maybe that being gay
that's
is a bad thing.
Yeah, and also there's a secondary trope that might fit better, which is not too gay, where a character kind of comes out as gay and they're like about to get into a relationship or something, but before it can get too explicit, they die or their gayness is never really like addressed in any way. They just sort of like reveal it once and then it's like whatever. And that's fine to a degree. You don't want to put like gay characters on a pedestal because that's just as bad in a different way. But you also...
Yeah, it's
yeah, but you also don't want to like just have it be, oh, hey, I'm gay. And it's like, cool, whatever. Let's never bring it up again. You know, it doesn't work that way. It does kind of change who you are when you come out. Even if it's not in a huge way, it does change you a bit.
Yeah, so what exactly do you think is the issue with the bury your gaze trope?
Well, let
me
explain the situation to you, and then you can give me your opinion. From chapter, like, 6 or 7... very early on, actually, in, like, chapter 1, they get introduced. There are these characters, Isabel and Elva. It's pretty heavily implied that Isabel is an artificial human as well, designed to protect Elva, but it's never described who made her, or if that's the case, or whatever. And Elva's, like, a super genius, who left Esther City with her grandfather to go and live in a place called New Dam City. She becomes essentially, like, the princess of this town. I don't know if she has any actual governmental powers, but she's just, like, everyone loves her. And she is wonderful. She's very sweet, she's very nice, she's kind of goofy, and she chats to you and stuff. And her and Isabel are pretty clearly in love. It's never explicitly stated, but it's very, very heavily implied. During, the climax of that chapter, you see... a device that worked previously, which was called the Buddha fan, it was used earlier to blow away the miasma when it encroached on the city. It stops working because the first iteration of Solomon breaks it. Elva sacrifices her life to fix the fan so that it can blow away the miasma again, and she gets really, really hurt. She doesn't wake up. She's in a coma. So Isabel takes her to Esther City. Prompting John and Sam to go after her, which takes you into the final chapters of the game. to get like a cure for Elva. Eventually, when you find Isabel and you have to fight her, she reveals that she put Elva into this like healing pod, very similar to what Sam was in, and they cloned her to make like presumably the perfect humans, pretty, smart, very few genetic faults at all. And Elva's ghost appears and speaks to Isabel to basically try and get her to let go, because none of the people in those pods are her, and she's gone. And Isabel says, like, you weren't supposed to be gone, and Elva says, like, but I am, and we have to deal with that now. And it's a very good scene. It's a very poignant scene. It kind of had to happen that she got hurt and died so that we could get to that other city, and for the tonal change in the game to make sense, because the rest of the game's kind of got this air of, like, finality to it now. But does it constitute bury your gays, or, like, bait and switch lesbian, or not too gay?
Yeah, so the argument, the issue that you're trying to bring up, mine specifically the exact trope, but the argument is basically, is this an example of referencing LGBT characters without necessarily giving them the weight or significance or space of actual, you know, other characters? And from everything that you've described and all the reading that I've done, I wouldn't say so. This game doesn't have many characters per se.
Well, it's got a bunch, but not like a whole lot of main cast. The main cast kind of changes in terms of every chapter.
Yeah, in terms of the main cast, you have relatively few people. And from what it sounds like Alva and Isabel are characters who have their own, like you said, they're characterized fairly well. Alva is an inventor. Isabel kind of like is a warrior assistant.
Think of her like
kind of a,
if Elva's a princess, Isabel's her knight kind of deal. They have like a
they have a whole princess bubblegum Marceline type thing going on.
I would say more like Zelda and Link.
Zelda and Link. Okay, that's actually good, because I think that the fact that they kill Elva in the way that they do kind of makes, like you said, it makes sense because she's the inventor lady that is also super important to everyone, right? And narratively, it makes sense in a way that she dies.
It would have the most weight.
That's like, yeah, it has the most weight. She's the most important character in a way, you know, especially in the context of the city, new damn city, right? And there isn't another character. Like, if they had just came up with another, so let's say you never get to. Let's say Alva is not the, you know, the princess. She is a character in the game, but there's like some other lady that just shows up randomly, right? And that person dies. And then it's like, oh, but I was in a relationship with this lady. That, I think, would be a lot worse, more patronizing, because Alva is developed as a character. She's developed as a character. She has real significance in the plot of the story. And as, you know, from what I understand, again, from reading, her death has meaningful, so, you know, meaningful impacts that continue to reverberate around the story. I think one of the issues is that once you've buried the gays, you don't talk about them anymore, right? But the fact that she dies leads Isabel to turn on the main party, right? And she has like a whole villain arc, right?
Well, sort of like an anti-hero Lancer arc.
Yeah, so that's meaningful, isn't it? That's like relevant to the story. It's developed in the context. It makes sense. You could understand that a person, like, the other thing is like, what is the feeling that's being expressed here? Could you understand if you had, let's say, a partner and that partner died? Maybe you would become in your emotional state, because you will be emotionally compromised if you cared for them deeply. Maybe that would then kind of make sense as to why you might fall down darkness.
Yeah,
you know?
What's really poignant about it is that Isabel and Elva's entire purpose throughout the game is that they're basically researching ways to stop the miasma from happening. And it's kind of revealed that the miasma keeps happening so that Solomon and Charon can create the perfect bit of humanity. But also, Solomon is obsessed with living forever. And it is kind of hard, it's gut-wrenching to see Isabel employing the same technology as Solomon, someone who is almost directly responsible for the thing that killed Elva, for the thing that, like, they've been trying to fix for years, seeing her use his technology to keep her alive past the point of naturalness. Like, this technology is kind of the reason the world is screwed up now. But what does that matter when the person you love is dead?
Yeah. Yeah, Solomon is a shadow archetype, because he's also a tech guy, that sort of contrasts against Alva, and whereas Alva and Isabel have a relationship that they care about, then they both care about each other. Solomon doesn't care about anything except for, you know, living forever and stuff, and so he's so selfish in that way. And so I can understand where you're coming from when you think that, yeah, maybe this might be a problematic aspect to it. And I certainly think it's worth talking about, right? Especially if you are trying to be a little bit more aware of the whole barrier gaze trope. However, I don't think it is. And I think we've sort of talked about the reasons why. I think they did the work to make this character feel like an actual character. Let me give you an example. So one of my favorite games, favorite point-and-click adventure games, but really just one of my favorite games for the sheer amount of variety and sort of like intricacy in the plot, is a game called Techno Babylon. I guess spoilers for Techno Babylon. And it's a point-and-click adventure game about being a future cop. And if there's anything that I like, God, it's about being a future police detective.
I've heard this song before.
Okay, but it's different because it's not a cyberpunk game. It's actually a post-cyberpunk game.
Wild. What comes after cyberpunk?
Yeah. That'll be another episode on its own, my man.
Yeah, let's talk about that one next. Neural net punk.
Yeah.
Multiverse punk. Crypto punk.
Oh, God. Yeah, post-cyberpunk is really interesting. I'm actually super interested in it. But anyway, so the game follows basically a guy he's a detective. He's got, you know, regrets and stuff like that. His partner in the police force is a lady called Max. And they have a very interesting relationship. They have the whole old cop, new cop type dynamic, right? Except they're both not really by the book cops. They're both actually kind of rebels, but they're rebels in a different way.
Oh, kind of like in Happy.
And, yeah, and halfway, not really halfway, but sort of like at one of the major climaxes of the story, you discover that Max is trans, and that they used to, well, you know, they go by she, her, but they used to be a guy. They used to be
they were assigned
a guy.
Male at birth.
And, yeah, they were assigned, yeah, there we go, that's the term I was looking for. They AMAB. Were assigned yeah. AMAB, and then they left their family, they faced huge social ostracization to get, you know, gender and sexual reassignment surgery, and they've been living as a woman, and no one knows about it, and they tell you this in confidence to demonstrate how much they trust you, right? Because, like, this is a serious moment in the story, and it's not brought up again in the story. However, it's incredibly meaningful, I think, in that moment, because it demonstrates the level of trust and sort of like, because you're building up this relationship. Initially, you don't really care about them. They're going to get, you know, your character's like, ah, this person is going to get in my way. I can do it, you know, by myself. But then over time, they learn and you teach them as well, because you have other methods. You're kind of this old technology curmudgeon, which I really love. And yeah, you could make an argument that, yeah, maybe it is kind of weird that they just bring up that they're trans, and it's never really brought up again, and it's never really talked about. But on the other hand, in the context of the story, yeah, it actually is a big, meaningful thing, because there is a subtle hint that they are a very guarded person, that Max is a very guarded person, and they don't like talking about their past. And sure, you can read into that a bunch of different things, but it does actually kind of make sense that maybe they were, you know, trans, and you didn't realize it, right? Because in the future, these types of surgeries and stuff like that are just so much better than what we have now.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of thing, I think, where, you see what I'm getting at, right? It could be problematic, but I don't think it is. There's the potential for it to be, and in a worse game,
yeah,
I think would be problematic.
It's how they're handled, really. I mean, like you said, it's set up. It's given its appropriate weight. That moment has... If you took that moment out of Technobabble, it wouldn't feel as good. It wouldn't be as good an experience. What we mean with, like, bury your gaze and the mistreatment of gay characters is when, like, a moment is just shoehorned in, or a character has clearly just been made gay to check off a checklist. It's fine to not make being gay their whole personality, or being trans, or being queer, or whatever, but, like, it does have to, you know, mean something in the story. There has to be a reason why you included a character from this community in your story. And I think, at worst, these games just have the hallmarks of these tropes, and we kind of automatically connect the dots in our brains. Like, we're just so used to seeing this trope that we're like, oh, it's this again.
Yeah, yeah, I think a lot of people have maybe a presumptive, not presumptive, but sort of like a hesitancy about these types of things, because it's done badly in general.
Yeah, and it's just sometimes characters die because people die. And that's just a thing that happens in the story. If it happened in, like, Game of Thrones, I'm sure it would, you know, spark some kind of outrage if, like, the only gay character in Game of Thrones died or whatever. But at the same time, people die in that show all the time. And you can't expect... It would be worse if, like, specifically these characters were the only ones that survived. Mm-hmm. But also Game of Thrones has a lot of its own racial issues, which might be a different episode.
It has, in general, problems.
It has, like, two black characters in, like, season 1 to 2, and they're both thieves.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, Game of Thrones is surprisingly committed to a better version of history, because there are places like Essos and stuff like that which are much more, you know, racially diverse than, you know, you might imagine, because they're based on medieval Spain, and medieval Spain was pretty racially diverse. But there are, like, lots of issues with Game of Thrones. We shouldn't get into that one, you know, right now, because I also think we're running out of time. Oh,
okay,
no.
Let's wrap this up. Ultimately, I think Eastwood is a game that may have hit me at the right time. It may have just been filled with, weirdly, the stuff that I really like. It may have even been just a moment of, I've seen so many games recently that were nothing like this, and it's new. And so it's great. But every time I think about it, there are reasons why I think it's good. And I think it's a game that deserves to be played. And I'm sorry that you had to listen to 1 hour and 7 minutes of me gushing about this game, view.
Well, Callum can have an episode like this as a treat.
I don't want you to say... I want so you to say that this was a good analysis of a game.
No, I actually think this is a really good analysis of a game, because I think I don't have a lot of experience playing these types of games. Certainly, you play these games more than I do, and I think that it's hard to talk about them. Like, it's really difficult to talk about a thing that you love, right? Especially if you want to be critical about it, because we don't just want to blindly follow our feelings into, you know, something where we're not actually cognizant of, you know, some issues and stuff like that. So I think that it's hard to talk about a thing that you love. It's very easy to talk about a thing that you don't love. A lot of the episodes that we've done are essentially just us, you know, dunking on a thing that we don't like. And that's good, right? But I think this episode is important because we do have strong opinions about video games, but it's very rare that we talk about a game that we just really, really like. And so,
I think this was
fun.
I think I've moved on to very story-heavy games now. I just don't get anything out of gameplay-heavy games as much as I do out of story-heavy. But yeah, I really like doing this episode. It was a lot of fun. I think if you do want to go and buy Eastwatch now, I'm sorry that we spoiled it, but you should definitely buy it on PC, because the Switch version crashes a lot.
There is a link to the Steam page in the description.
Thank you very much for watching. If you want more content like this, please like and subscribe and share the video and comment and tell us that you want more content like this. But also, a couple of things. Go and visit our Patreon if you want this to become my full-time job and Emilio's maybe full-time job.
This would be like my fourth job.
His fourth job. Yeah, my fourth job, guys. check us out every Wednesday and Saturday for a Hollow Knight stream on Wednesday and an art stream on Saturday. And remember to check out our community page for a bunch of the causes that we're trying to get supported. If you donate to them, send us your proof of payment and a little letter that they send you for donating, you get access to all of our Patreon videos.
Yes, and the other thing that I wanted to bring up is that for the 100th video...
Is that all you have to say about that?
Oh.
Sorry.
Follow the links in the description. Donate to those really good causes. Help people in Ukraine, Durban, all over the world that are struggling. If you just send us the proof and your bank details, we'll give you access to the bonus episodes. More bonus content is coming. And speaking of bonus content,
yeah,
we are going to do for our 100th video, the plan is right now to do a Enter the Gungeon stream, but Callum and I are going to be playing together, which is a first for this channel, really. So look out for that as well.
And also, I've been seeing some activity on the, whatchamacallit? What's that detective game? The really good one about communism?
Disco Elysium.
I've been seeing some activity on our Disco Elysium Let's Play. If you guys want that to come back, you do have to let us know in the comments. And we're almost at 1,000 subscribers. Help us.
Yeah.
Then we can beg you for money directly.
Yeah, and then we could do a sellout sponsorship.
No, that only happens at 2,000. But at 1,000, you can donate to the channel. And then, like, you can help us make this a more full-time thing. This has been so great. Thank you so much for watching. I love you. Love you too, Amelia.
Bye.
You don't
love you too, Callum.
Bye.
Bye.